really is going to revolutionize, I think, our ability to operate in remote locations.
The state looks at using airships to solve some transportation challenges. From the Alaska Public Radio Network, this is Alaska News Nightly for Wednesday, August 24th. Good evening, I'm Lori Townsend. Also tonight, Senator Begich leads a meeting on the proposed charter halibut rules in Homer.
You know, fish wars are a pain in the ass.
Yeah.
Okay? Let me just say that very bluntly.
Those stories and more tonight on Alaska News Nightly.
Today's broadcast of Alaska News Nightly is presented by Northern Air Cargo. For over 54 years, Alaskans have entrusted Northern Air Cargo to transport their freight. Thank you, Alaska, for the opportunity to serve you for decades to come. And by
AT&T, rethink possible. Details at att.com/Alaska or 1-800-252-7266.
Officials from the state and NASA are leading a workshop in Anchorage to talk about the potential for airship transportation in Alaska. The futuristic-looking dirigibles are being hailed as a potential solution to the state's transportation challenges. These days, they work with helium instead of hydrogen to make them safer. Pete Warden is director of NASA's Ames Research Center in California. He says the new airships use 19th century technology that's been updated to make it safe, reliable, and cheap. And he says there are different kinds.
Some of them fly like airplanes, some of them fly like balloons. But what one does is you can, the standard airship, I mean, and I, really the word airship is probably the best description. It's a ship that that goes through the air. Maybe a better thing would call it an air submarine because it doesn't fly on top of the atmosphere. It flies through the atmosphere. But a standard airship, when it sits on the ground, its buoyancy caused by the lighter-than-air gas exactly balances the weight of the cargo and the ship itself. If you want to go up, there's a couple ways to go up. One is to drop some ballast, which is sand or water or something. But the way the modern ones work is that they have engines on them. They turn the engines so that they are facing down, and that drives the airship up into the air, and then they can change the orientation of the engines to drive it forward. And one of the really appealing things for the state of Alaska is that having a lot of remote locations that can only be gotten to by air, if you can bring an airship in where you don't have to have even a very simple airfield, really changes things a lot, plus the ability to hover. So it really is going to revolutionize, I think, our ability to operate in remote locations.
And Director Warden, in your conversations with Lieutenant Governor Treadwell, what do you see as the primary uses for airships in Alaska?
Well, golly, we're having a conference here today, and there's sort of dozens of ones you might think of and a few that you might not. But a perfect example is as there are more and more operations that are mining or oil extraction in remote locations, this enables us to get equipment in and out of those locations with virtually no impact to the surrounding environment. One doesn't have to build a road across certain locations. It also provides potentially all year-round access. Today, I understand many of these locations are only accessible by ice roads in the winter. So it could really change our ability to get to remote locations. Another very important aspect is the ability to handle natural disasters like floods and other natural disasters, to actually get large amounts of equipment in to rescue people, to provide supplies. In fact, the U.S. Department of Defense is very interested in this technology and has been supporting it for some of their relief operations, that where it's very difficult to get lots of equipment and supplies in quickly.
Well, it certainly sounds promising. What are the biggest challenges to seeing these types of airships become more widely used?
Well, it's happening now that a lot of industry, in fact, at our conference here, there's probably seven or eight major industries that are building or will soon build airships. Probably the biggest issue is really just raising the resources, either from private or public sector, to start building things. To be sure, there are technological challenges of building some of the bigger ones. I mean, we don't know how to do that yet. But today, things that could carry tens of tons are very much in the works, and we think within 5 to 10 years, airships that could carry hundreds of tons that could even exceed the capacity of our largest airliners will be around.
Pete Warden directs NASA's Ames Research Center. The workshop is being held at the University of Alaska Anchorage. It wraps up tomorrow. It's no secret that Homer charter captains are upset about NOAA's new halibut catch share proposal, which would mean a one fish per angler rule in the Gulf of Alaska under most circumstances. At a meeting Tuesday with Senator Mark Begich and NOAA Chief Jane Lubchenco, a large group of them let their feelings be heard. KBBI's Aaron Selbig was at the meeting and files this report.
A crowd of more than 200 people poured into the upstairs meeting room at Homer's Best Western Bidarka Inn Tuesday afternoon. Charter captains, commercial fishermen, Chamber of Commerce members, City Council members, and Mayor Jim Hornaday all were there to hear what the esteemed guests had to say about the complex new proposed halibut catch-sharing plan and what it might mean for Homer's charter fleet.
Okay, folks, one more time, I need your attention. Just in case you do not know how this is going to work.
Chamber Director Monty Davis, who helped coordinate the event, held a 2-inch-thick stack of index cards in his hand, each one of them with a handwritten question from the audience.
What impact do you think the implementation of a one fish per angler will have on this and surrounding communities? How will the new limited entry affect the catch sharing plan? This plan is being promoted as a conservation plan. To me, a conservation means no one would be able to catch these fish. Isn't this really just a reallocation of those fish from sport to commercial? How long will Alaskans enjoy a fishery that allows them to provide for their families?
As Senator Mark Begich and NOAA Chief Dr. Jane Lubchenco looked on and took notes, Davis went through just about every question in the pile. Many of them covered the same ground. Was there an adequate study of the possible economic effects of the new rules? Is this an allocation or a conservation issue? Why not wait to see what the effect is of the new limited entry rules for charter halibut vessels? And would it be possible to extend the September 6th deadline for public comment? Lubchenco took a shot at answering questions from the restless, standing room only crowd.
So thank you everybody for those questions. Clearly there are a lot of really challenging issues. I think that it's useful to focus on sort of the historical perspective here. We didn't get into this challenging situation overnight.
Lubchenco cited the 1976 Magnuson-Stevens Act and NOAA's responsibility to end overfishing nationwide, but that was not the answer most of the Homer charter captains wanted to hear. The crowd soon grew a bit more restless, and then Senator Begich jumped in.
Hold on, you guys. Hold on, let me, you know, fish wars are a pain in the ass.
Yeah.
Okay? Let me just say that very bluntly. And it means there's winners and there's losers.
After public comments are reviewed, the plan will be sent to Secretary of Commerce Gary Locke, who has the power to approve it or send it back to the North Council. Lubchenco reiterated that NOAA's primary goal is to ensure the long-term sustainability of the halibut fishery.
That's not something that economics can affect. That takes a priority because we want a fishery to be able to bring economic benefit down the road.
Begich is chairman of the Senate Oceans, Atmosphere, Fisheries, and Coast Guard Subcommittee. He said the committee and the U.S. Senate in general has historically done a bad job of overseeing the effects of their own rulings.
And what I mean by that is we pass these laws where regulation occurs, and then we go on to some other issue. And then a crisis occurs, and then we all run and scurry around and create some other crisis legislation and hope it all goes away. And then 5 years later, we do the same routine.
Begich promised the Homer crowd that when and if the new halibut catch-sharing plan goes into effect, proper oversight would be conducted. In Homer, I'm Aaron Selbig.
Still to come on Alaska News Nightly, military widows gather in Girdwood for a healing and adventurous retreat.
I'm really nervous about this. But I'm going to do it, and my husband would be really proud of me because he did stuff like this all of the time. He was a nut.
That's ahead. Stay with us.
Alaska News Nightly is brought to you in part by
Alyeska Pipeline Service Company, committed to safety, operating the Trans-Alaska Pipeline with over 700 employees.
Whether visiting Barrow or attending business in Juneau, APRN goes with listeners wherever they roam. Your company's message can span across Alaska on 26 stations. Find out how by calling 907-550-8437.
The war on terror has created a lot of military widows in the U.S. since it began in 2001. But it can be difficult for grieving wives to connect with people who understand what they're going through. An organization that was founded in Alaska more than a decade ago helps bridge the gap. TAPS, or Tragedy Assistance Program for Survivors, held a widow's retreat in Girdwood and Anchorage last week. APRN's Annie Feit visited one morning and has this story.
Cheryl Dodson has never rappelled down a cliff before.
Is this how this goes?
Thank you.
Yep.
Okay.
And as she puts on her climbing harness and helmet, she is seriously considering chickening out.
I'm really nervous about this.
But she signed up for the morning's canyoneering adventure at Crow Creek Mine. And by the time she's suited up, she sounds determined to go through with it.
I was in the van thinking, okay, I'm totally not doing this. This is silly. I'm not doing this. But I'm going to do it. And my husband would be really proud of me because he did stuff like this all of the time. He was a nut.
Dodson is from Fayetteville, North Carolina. Her husband, Captain Michael Dodson, was killed in an aviation accident in Guam in 2008. TAPS is a resource for grieving family members and loved ones of anyone who dies serving the military. This widow's retreat is just one of several events they hold around the country each year for siblings, parents, partners, and wives. Nikki Bunting's husband was killed in 2009 by an IUD in Afghanistan. A few days later, she found out she was pregnant. Bunting says the retreat is helping her feel normal again.
You know, when I'm out with my friends or whatever, I always feel like I don't fit in. I always look around and I get jealous, you know. And so I feel like I just kind of have a piece of normalcy back, and I don't feel like an outsider.
And Nikki seems to be in her element here. When the guide, Andy, asks who wants to go first, she quickly volunteers. She clips into the rope as Andy offers some last-minute tips.
Now, you're going to have to work this through a little bit, this rope. It's a pretty good-sized rope. So go ahead and just grab with that brake hand. That right hand stays on the rope.
Mm-hmm. Nikki takes a deep breath and slowly, very slowly, backs up over the cliff.
You're doing good. Hey, smile this way. Yeah, that's kind of a smile. Okay, now look for that edge. And now Indiana Jones. All right, who's up?
For most of these women, this is their first time doing anything like this. That's true for Jessica Bird, who even admits she's scared of heights. There were tamer activities she could have chosen this morning, like a hike, but she begged to join the canyoneering trip. Jessica has been grieving the loss of her husband since 2004, and she's learned that there's something powerful about sharing an adrenaline-fueled adventure.
You know, after you have that experience, and you've shared that experience, and you've conquered it, and laughed and cried and, you know, got your butt kicked and you're muddy and everything. And, you know, at the end of the day, when it does come time to sit down for dinner or during those nights, which a lot of us call widow hours when we can't sleep and everything, we have these people that we shared a bond with that we can call.
At the bottom of the cliff, the women who've already rappelled cheer on their friends. Emily Alley says she almost stopped breathing at the top, but making it down safely was the highlight of the retreat for her, although she knew even before coming that she would love every minute of it.
My friends and family at home, they're like, wait, you're going to this thing where you don't know anybody? I'm like, no, you guys don't understand. It's okay that we don't know anybody. And coming right off the plane, we immediately, oh, hi, click, let's go get something to eat. We're friends instantly because, you know, you've gone through something. Most people haven't gone through, and it's a bond like you would believe.
Emily says during her daily life back home in Utah, she can't dwell on the loss of her husband. But here, the emotions come to the surface, and she says it's a welcome release. She looks up, and it's Cheryl Dodson's turn on the ropes. The woman who almost chickened out at the beginning of the story is now bouncing down the cliff as if she does this for fun every day.
Look at you, girl!
Yay! Heck yeah.
At the bottom, she's still shaking a bit when I ask her to describe the experience.
That was so awesome. I can't believe I did it. Yay! It was exhilarating. It was awesome. I want to do a bigger one now.
Yeah. The women already share the grief of losing their husbands, and now they have a very different reason to bond. The thrill of conquering their fears and rappelling down a cliff in Alaska. In Girdwood, I'm Annie Feit.
Besides visiting the Tongass in South Central, the head of the U.S. Forest Service and National Resource Conservation Service, Harris Sherman, also spent 3 days in western Alaska. From member station KYUK in Bethel, Angela Denning Barnes reports.
While forestry is limited in western Alaska, small-scale conservation projects are not. USDA Undersecretary Harris Sherman says he'd like to expand the National Resource Conservation Service's presence in the state.
I think we need to do more work in Alaska. We're very well known in other parts of the United States, but we're fairly new to the work in Alaska. So we're anxious to reach out, partner with local communities here, and I think NRCS can play a very valuable role going forward.
Sherman says one important role the NRCS can play in rural Alaska is through tribal conservation districts. The districts are created by tribes as a way to organize participation in conserving their land. And for the NRCS, it creates a vehicle for USDA programs to get to the communities. Although there are over 30 such districts in the lower 48, there are just 3 in Alaska. The village of Kwitluk was the first tribe to form one in western Alaska 2 years ago. Max Angilan, tribal administrator for Kwitluk, says they pursued a tribal conservation district to protect their local river.
Especially for our Kwitluk River, so that they can control conservation of our resources.
The Kwitluk River is a main tributary of the Kuskokwim, and the village is built on its riverbanks. Sherman says when he visited by boat, residents were specifically concerned about erosion.
It's quite remarkable the degree to which the erosion has occurred on the banks of the river, and I think the village is rightfully concerned about how you protect all of these homes.
Sherman says he knows erosion is affecting many areas in western Alaska, and although the NRCS may not be able to fund an erosion project directly, the service can help in other ways.
One of the things we certainly can do is to work with the village to help facilitate conversations with the state of Alaska, with other federal agencies. For example, the Army Corps of Engineers might potentially have a role here, the Bureau of Indian Affairs, other Department of Interior, and USDA agencies.
One way that the NRCS can directly help communities in rural areas is through high tunnel projects for gardening. They're plastic-covered Quonset hut-type seasonal tents that extend the growing season. Kwitluk is working on installing 3 of them for next summer. Again, Tribal Administrator Max Angilan.
Families could plant vegetables so they would have some source of food, nutrition, and fresh produce.
Kwitluk is the first village in western Alaska to get high tunnels, but Sherman says the potential is great.
If you can extend the growing season by 4 weeks, 6 weeks, 8 weeks, it can make a tremendous difference. And I am very hopeful that this project will be successful. And if it is successful, we can replicate it in other villages in this part of Alaska.
Sherman says villages do not have to have a tribal conservation district in order to work with NRCS on projects like high tunnels, but the districts do help streamline efforts. The NRCS state office is based out of Palmer. In Bethel, I'm Angela Denning Barnes.
The Yukon-Kuskokwim Health Corporation held a groundbreaking ceremony for a care facility in Bethel this week. Once constructed, it will be the only place in all of western Alaska to offer disabled elders around-the-clock care. For member station KYUK in Bethel, Shane Iverson has more.
Elders from the senior center are unloading from a bus to take part in the festivity. The crowd gathers in the sand lot where the new building will go. They're under a temporary shelter. On a cloudy and windy day, they're there to see the official groundbreaking.
This has been a long journey, trying to get a place for our elders.
YKHC board member James Charlie Sr. of Tuksuk Bay.
I've been on the board for 17 years, and at the time I got in, they were talking about a place where our elders can be, where to be near their relatives and to eat their own food.
For many of the elderly with disabilities, the only option for around-the-clock care has been facilities located in Anchorage. Senator Lyman Hoffman says it's a story he's seen several times.
Many of them are heartbroken by the fact that they have to leave their family, their friends, and it just breaks their heart.
Hoffman, along with other lawmakers and lobby efforts by the Health Corporation, have resulted in 2 years of funding for the project coming from the state of Alaska. That total is over $16 million. Which is enough for a modest facility, says Health Corporation President Gene Peltola.
It's a great monumental event, breaking ground on this facility today, and it'll be even a greater day when this facility opens up for operations.
The first phase of the project will house up to 18 elders. It will be built in a way to allow for easy expansion if new construction money becomes available in the future. Charlie says that's reason for others to be hopeful, including himself.
I hope that when I get old, I'll get benefit from it too.
Yeah. YKHC hopes to open the long-term care facility by the end of 2012. With help from Dean Swope and Mike Martz, I'm Shane Iverson.
Alaska News Nightly is brought to you in part by your local public radio station. The Federal Aviation Administration sets standards for the operation of aircraft in airports and provides services to the flying public. Passengers are influential in making flying safer in Alaska, so when passengers know their rights and responsibilities, aviation is safer for everyone. There's more information online at faa.gov/go/flyalaska or toll-free at 1-866-357-4704. This message sponsored by the FAA.
A pair of small, high-end cruise lines are expanding their Alaska fleets. The Seattle-based companies are filling some of the void left when Cruise West went out of business about a year ago. Coast Alaska's Ed Schoenfeld reports.
Intersea Discoveries already sails between Juneau and Ketchikan. Sister company American Safari sails three luxury yachts from Juneau to Glacier Bay and other locations. Both plan to expand Alaska sailings to capture an increasing American market.
A lot of people are choosing to stay home and not travel over to Europe, where, of course, the dollar is not doing so well.
Tim Jaycox is Executive Vice President of Sales and Marketing for the lines. He says the exchange rate is also making Alaska more attractive to foreign travelers.
So you're going to see more international visitors. And so we had a banner year this year and expect the same next year, from especially the Australia and New Zealand markets.
He also says the growth is helped by the great deal the company's got on out-of-use Cruise West vessels. The longtime small ship line ended its business last August. Intersea Discoveries recently announced it will add the 76-passenger Wilderness Explorer to its Alaska roster next summer. Week-long trips between Sitka and Juneau will include Glacier Bay and other remote areas. The ship used to sail southeast as Cruise West's 86-berth Spirit of Discovery. Jaycox says it's being renovated to be less crowded and provide more amenities.
We'll go ahead and change out the lounge with more of a 1940s National Park Service lodge motif, a pub type of atmosphere for sharing stories of all of the events of the day and the evening. And so we'll install 10 microbrew taps to make that happen.
Fares will range from $3,000 to $6,000 for seven-day trips. American Safari, Intersea's higher-end sister brand, has acquired Cruise West's 102-passenger Spirit of Endeavor. It's now called the Safari Endeavor and is being reconfigured to handle 86 passengers. It will sail from Juneau to Glacier Bay, Endicott Arm, and Icy Strait. Jaycox says 8 berths are being turned into 2 4-room suites with outside balconies. The company will also add massage rooms and hot tubs.
And then with the additional space, we'll be adding a wine bar in the lounge area and also a library in the dining room area. So those are additional public spaces and meeting areas that didn't exist on that boat before.
Fares will start at about $4,800. The company is also adding the former Cruise West Spirit of 98, which will become the Safari Legacy. It will also be refurbished with tours starting in 2013. Sailings between Sitka and Juneau will also include Glacier Bay. This is Ed Schoenfeld in Juneau.
The cleanup and repair work continues in Petersburg at the site of last weekend's landslide into a downtown stream. The event was caused by heavy rain and took out a large section of parking lot and hillside behind the Public Works building on Saturday. The city has since built an access road to the bottom of the slide. KFSK's Matt Lichtenstein stopped by the site for an update this morning.
A worker cuts down a tree along one side of the slide and a backhoe digs nearby. A newly built gravel ramp provides vehicle access to the huge pile of rock, soil, bushes, and trees below. Public Works Director and Acting City Manager Carl Hagerman says the city finished the access ramp on Monday.
With help from some local contractors, it really went a lot quicker than I thought it was going to. We got this road that comes down across the front of the slide area. And this is going to allow us to get down into the debris that's in the creek and start working on that today, hopefully.
A few pieces of fence and guardrail stick out of the debris pile, and tarps cover the steep face of the drop-off left behind by the slide above the slough. The creek's still flowing, though it's shifted to the south and flows around the pile over the unoccupied grassy bank adjacent to its original path.
The latest news on the debris in the creek is that in conversations with the Corps of Engineers and Fish and Game Habitat Office in Juneau, the city is going to be allowed to recover the trees and stumps from the debris, but the bulk of the rock and soils is going to stay where it ended up at as a result of the slide.
The idea being that too much disturbance could send a lot of the debris downstream and cause more problems for the small fish run in the slough.
You know, the damage from the slide has been done, but if we try to remove that material from the creek, it's just going to make things worse.
As far as fixing the slope and preventing another slide, the city has an engineer from Paratovich, Nottingham & Drage working on that. Hagerman says the city has now submitted its written disaster declaration to the state in the hopes of getting some financial and technical assistance with cleanup and repairs. In Petersburg, I'm Matt Lichtenstein.
And that's all for this edition of Alaska News Nightly. If you missed any of tonight's stories, we're online at alaskapublic.org. You can follow us on Twitter at APRN. We had reports tonight from Aaron Selbig in Homer, Angela Denning Barnes, and Shane Iverson in Bethel, Ed Schoenfeld in Juneau, and Matt Lichtenstein in Petersburg. Our editor and producer is Annie Feit. Our audio engineer is Dave Waldron. And I'm Laurie Townsend. Good night.
Alaska News Nightly was made possible by
Crowley, providing tanker escorts, fuel delivery, and energy support services to Alaskans for over 50 years. From Valdez to the North Slope, Crowley knows Alaska. Crowley.com.
Check the status of your application at pfd.alaska.gov. August 31st is the deadline for placing half in a college savings account and to add or change charitable donations. This message sponsored by the state of Alaska. The future of how Alaskans will produce the energy we need for our homes and businesses is uncertain. The Renewable Energy Alaska Project is committed to developing Alaska's vast renewable energy resources to create a clean, local, and sustainable energy supply. Learn more at realaska.org. This message sponsored by REAP, committed to creating a sustainable economic future for Alaska.
You can find APRN headlines from around the state online at alaskapublic.org. There you'll discover local and worldwide news, upcoming events, and statewide community conversation. AlaskaPublic.org, connecting you to Alaska one story at a time.
This is APRN, the Alaska Public Radio Network.